Good to see you this morning. Hope that you were able to enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday, whether you went somewhere or someone came to you or you spent time with family or loved ones, whatever it was. I hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving this morning. It's good to see you here. I just wanted to start by saying congratulations to my brother-in-law, Andy. His team won the state semifinal, and they'll play in state next week, so very excited for him. Been at Reed's for 3 years, and we're all very, very proud of Andy and his accomplishment, and for Kirsten for putting up with Andy over the last 3 years. So if you get a chance, make sure you congratulate them. Big, big accomplishment. If you have your Bible, flip over or turn it on to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. That's where we're going to be this morning. Over the last couple of weeks, we have spent time thinking and reflecting on the table, reflecting on the Lord's Supper. Bill has been helping us to think about the ways in which our participation or observation of the Lord's Supper changes us. I appreciated what Kenneth said in his thoughts earlier, that this is something that we do, that we don't just spectate or just observe, but that is something that should be doing something to us. When we come to the table, it ought to be a transformational experience. It ought to shape and form and mold the ways in which we see God. And that's something that we have been thinking about. Last week, go ahead and put up this next one. Last week, we thought about how the Lord's Supper helps to shape us, how we see Jesus and what we owe to Him. We owe Him, as Bill pointed out, our widest gratitude, see if I can get this right, our longest loyalty, our highest respect, and our deepest trust. What He has done for us, what He has sacrificed, what He has given up ought to cause in us these things. We see Him in a new way. Our relationship to Him and to God changes in a very deep and fundamental way. One of the ways in which we could think about this is job one of the Christian is to love God. When Jesus was asked what the greatest command was, He said, first, to love God with all your heart, with all your mind, and with all your strength. That looks a lot like owing Him our gratitude, our loyalty, our respect, and our trust. That's job number one for anyone who would follow Christ. Anyone who would call themselves a follower of Jesus is first to love God, to owe Him these things about our life. This morning what I want to do is I want to think about one other way in which coming to the table ought to shape us, ought to change us, and transform us. And that is job number two, to love others. And this is what Jesus said. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your mind, and the second command is just like it. Think about that. It's just like it, to love others. And it's this that I want to talk about. I want us to think about how the Lord's Supper and our observation of it should shape and change the way we think about loving people. And the way we're going to do that is by looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Now, chances are, when I mention 1 Corinthians 13, you had an associated emotion or feeling or experience come to mind when I mention this passage. Often, when is this passage most used? What's the last event you remember hearing this passage read at? A wedding. How many of you would say you've heard this passage mentioned or read at a wedding? I'm guilty of this myself. Because it's a beautiful passage on the nature of love. However, what I think we sometimes miss is understanding that Paul did not have a marriage relationship in mind when he wrote this passage. He didn't write this in the middle of his letter as some beautiful aside to the nature of the love that is shared between a man and a woman. But I think the reason it's read is because while that's not what he had in mind, it is appropriate to think about this as being the nature of love that a man should have for his wife and a wife for her husband, because it's the kind of love that should exist between all humans, period. Regardless of being in a relationship or not. This is the sort of love that should exist between all people. Because Paul has written this in the middle of dealing with some issues and some problems that the Corinthian church is having. See, when they get together on a Sunday, they're doing it in ways that's harmful and damaging to one another. Beginning way back earlier in like chapter 10 and 11, he's dealing with the Lord's Supper. And he's saying, when you come together, you're doing it in ways that's harmful to each other. You're doing it in ways that uses status and reputation and money and power and using the Lord's Supper as a weapon to harm other people. Because you're meeting together when you can at your leisure and you're going ahead and doing everything and celebrating, and then those who have less, who are working or coming in late, and there's not as much for them, and it's just creating separation and division. It's being used as a tool not to bring people together, but instead to create separation and differences. And then he goes on to say, and what about the gifts that you practice during worship? You're using those things as ways to harm each other as well, because you're saying, well, this guy does these things and has these gifts, and they are obviously so much better than gifts that another person might have. And again, it's creating distinctions and separations within the church rather than understanding these gifts are meant to all, again, work together. And so right in the middle of all of that, Paul inserts this chapter on love, and he says, this is the answer. This is how you fix all of the problems. This is how you deal with all of the strife and the difficulty and the damage, how you handle all of that, by having love. Now, what does he mean by love? You know, this is a tricky word in English, right? Because the word love I use to say how I feel about, you know, like Mexican food. Like, I love Mexican food. My kids hate it. Probably because I love it so much, and that's all I ever want to eat. But that's the same word I use to describe how I feel about my wife, Carrie. I love her. Do I love her the way I love Mexican food? Maybe. But it's also the word that I use to describe her, and it's the word I use to describe, like, the Indianapolis Colts. Except, well, this year, it's more like disgust is probably the best word to use this year. But it's a tricky word, right? But we understand, we intuitively know that we have varying levels of love that we mean. I wish that we had like the Hebrew or the Greek where we have all these different words that we use to describe love. So what is it that Paul's talking about? The thing I want us to firmly fix in our minds this morning is that the love he is talking about isn't some general vague sense of love. It is not a worldly definition of love. It is not sort of a romantic, emotional feeling of love. In fact, if you think about all the words that he mentions, they are all more choice than they are emotion. He's not thinking about a love of God, even. The word that he uses that most of you will be familiar with is agape. Now, what that means is, this is the love that God has for his people. That's the love that he has in mind. The kind of love that God has. God has a fatherly love for his people. Now, what Paul is going to say is that we need to have the love that God has for us towards others. That is the kind of love that's at play. Not a general, vague, undirected sense of love, but a love specifically focused on other people. And to get a better sense of this, I want to pull up the next slide here. I want us to take a look at ways in which Paul has used this in the past, and then a couple of ways that we see it in other places. In Galatians, he says, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer me that lives this life, but Christ is living in me or through me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and what? Gave himself for me. Love defined as the giving of oneself for another person. In Ephesians 5, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children. Walk in love as Christ walked and loved, giving himself up for us a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. This is a love that is about not taking, but about sacrifice, about giving up oneself for another person. But God shows his love for us. This is now God's love for us in that while we were sinners, he gave his son to die for us. That's the love we're talking about. Look at what Jesus says. Go to the next slide here. There we go. John 13, a new commandment I give to you, love one another as I have loved you. Jesus is redefining love. And of course, we have hindsight, right? We understand exactly the depths of Jesus' love for us. A love that took him all the way to the cross. A love that cared not for his own wants, his own desires, his own well-being, but solely was thinking about what he could do for the sake of the other person. Summed up in John, 1 John 3:16, we know love by this. He laid down his life for us, and so we also should lay down our lives for another. That is the kind of love that Paul has in mind. This is agape love. This is the love that Paul turns to say, this is what's missing. It's this expressed towards others. And so he writes this beautiful passage that falls into three pretty neat sections. The primacy of love, the character of love, and the endurance of love. We won't have time to really look at all of these because I want to spend most of my time in the middle one. But I want to start with the primacy of love. Paul says that this is foundational. That's what this means. This love is foundational to everything else that you do. It's the lens, it's the vehicle, it's the thing that makes everything else work. Look at what he says, starting in verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I don't have love, I am simply a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and I understand all the mysteries and all the knowledge, and if I have all the faith so as to be able to move mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I have not love, I gain nothing. I want you to think about what it is he's saying. First, you might notice that all the words and things that he talks about are all things he's mentioned in other places in Corinthians as issues that they specifically are having about what's best. What Paul is saying is there is no act of worship, there is no act of service, there is no amount of faith that means anything apart from loving others. It does not matter what you do. It doesn't matter how many times you fill a pew. It doesn't matter how many mission trips you go on. It doesn't matter how many arguments you try to win or how much you understand. If you don't have love for people, it means nothing. So much of the time we get focused on the wrong kinds of things. I just need to know enough things, have the right arguments, and then I'll be able to, you know, achieve or do or whatever. But if we don't love the people, it's not going to matter. Paul says all the things that you're doing, all the ways that you're trying to divide yourselves and hold yourselves apart, all the things that you've got going on, none of it matters because it's tearing you apart, not bringing you together. I wore boots this morning because my toes get a little squished in this passage, and this is certainly one of them because this is a question I need to ask of myself. If Paul were writing this to me, what specific things might he include? It doesn't matter how great your sermon is. It doesn't matter how many great events you plan for the youth or kids or whatever. If you don't actually love the people, none of it matters. That's the primacy of love. It's foundational to everything that we do. Are we doing things that are bringing us together and building one another up, or doing it just to do it? And then he moves on to talk about the character of love. And this is where I really want to spend some time this morning. Often when this is read, and I admit I'm the first one, I do this, I take it as sort of a big picture type thing. I read all of the things together and just sort of walk away with one sort of just mushed impression of what he's talking about. And I might go so far as to even point out, like, you know, there, as I said, there, these are choices, not emotions. These are things we choose to do or ways to behave towards another person. And so that's what love is. But what I want us to think about is to slow down and to really think, what does Paul mean? Because he isn't interested in this being an academic experience for us, a way to understand, oh, yeah, okay, I get a good general idea of what love is. He means for this to be a transformational experience. Because the problems are not going to be fixed in Corinth if they just have a mental understanding of what he's saying. But they need to look at this in light of their own behavior, their own actions, and wonder, where do I line up and where do I fall short? So my encouragement to you this morning is to think through this with me. and be asking yourself the question again and again, am I here or am I here? Because that is what Paul intends with this list. He begins in a positive way. He says, love is patient and love is kind. I come across this grouping as I was researching and studying and preparing for this. And this is, if you know the Bible Project and Tim Mackey, I saw him have something where he arranged it this way. And I thought it was really helpful to kind of understand or see sort of how these things fit together and how this is sort of grouped together. And it begins in a positive way. He says, love is patient and love is kind. So what does that mean and what does it look like? Love is patient. What does it mean to be patient? Patience is, I have time to give to another person. Again, all of this is other focused. Patience is the ability to give time to another person, to realize that my time isn't so valuable that it allows me to ignore everyone else around me. To be patient is to be willing to extend grace and time to another person. Impatience is the opposite of that. I don't have time for you. I don't have time to listen to what you've got going on. I don't have time to stop and talk. Jesus was patient. You think about how many times he allowed himself to be interrupted. He was on the way somewhere. He was going. He was moving. He was doing. And he allowed himself to stop and to slow down and to give time to the people who needed him to give time. Are you a person who has the ability to give time to someone else? And love is kind. And this word is really like a pleasantness. And it has to do with atmosphere. Love, a person who loves in this way, is the kind of person who thinks about another's perception or experience when they're in their presence. Okay? Think about that. What is another person's experience of you? That's kindness. When someone comes into my presence, when someone interacts with me, do they leave feeling better about themselves or worse? Do they leave going away feeling like I was seen, I was heard? Or do they leave saying, oh man, I just made them mad, or I got them irritated or whatever? If you've ever thought about someone who is, you know, you have to walk on eggshells around, that's what we're talking about. Kindness is the ability to understand the effect you have on another person. Do they leave an experience with you feeling better about themselves or worse? And then he moves to 8 descriptors of what love is not. Now, sometimes something is so profound it can only be really understood by looking at the opposite of it. And what I mean by that is like sometimes there are things that we don't do well, and the only way to really understand what we should be doing is by highlighting or identifying where we're going wrong. And that's what Paul does. He begins by saying, love is not jealous or envious, depending on your translation. So love has the ability to rejoice with another person's good fortune without being miserable. I can experience your joy or your good fortune and not perceive it as just a lack in my own life. And really, that's what being jealous or envious is all about. Now, this isn't like I'm excited for you, but you know, man, it is tough because I'm not quite there or whatever. That's different. This is like I'm only so focused on perceiving your good fortune as my lack that I cannot be joyful for you. That it just makes me miserable and it makes me angry. That's what he's talking about. It does not brag. Have you ever known someone who could not stand to see another person have any attention? Maybe someone else has good fortune, and rather than allow that person to experience the good fortune, they immediately begin to bring the focus back to themselves. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where I see that you've got something good, and rather than let you keep the attention, I need to begin talking about my own accomplishments, my own things, so that attention will be brought back to me, and I can receive some of the goodwill that you're getting, or maybe all of the goodwill that you're getting. And then we wonder, why would a person do that? Paul says, because love is also not arrogant. Literally, this says inflated or puffed up. It means that this person who does not love in this way is genuinely believes that their thing is the only thing. They genuinely believe that they are at the center of the universe. They genuinely believe that they are more important than everyone else. And a person who thinks this way and feels this way not only talks about themselves more than they should, but they behave in ways that Paul says is rude. Now, what do we mean by this? This is like acting in a way that invalidates a person's dignity or damages a person's dignity. This is acting in a way that makes someone feel less than they are. You know, there was a movie a long time ago called Mean Girls. I don't know if you remember this, but it kind of became like if you got mean girled. That was a way of saying someone treated you in such a way that made you feel less than human. Someone who thinks and is so absorbed in what they have going on that it is the most important thing, that they act in ways that dehumanize someone, that make them feel less than who they are. And then he goes into this next section. Love does not seek its own way. Love is not something that only believes its priorities, its interests, its values, its way of doing things is the most important thing. This is when you consistently prioritize your own agenda and your own thing so as to overlook or devalue another person. Now, sometimes it's important for us to prioritize, right? Sometimes we have things that we need to take care of, or we have to take care of ourselves. And that's not this. This is when you consistently prioritize your own agenda, your own will, your own way, that it causes casualties. Casualties like being easily angered or irritable. The kind of person that prioritizes their own thing, their own priorities, what happens when they don't get their way? What happens when things don't go their way? What happens when they come into contact with other people who have differing priorities or values or who don't think their way is the only way? Well, it makes you angry. You get irritated. And when you get angry and irritated, you also never forget about it. And you hold grudge. And you begin to resent the other person. And you begin to treat them differently from then on because this is a person who doesn't see it my way. When we lose the ability to try to think from another person's point of view, to at least hear and to see and to have a conversation, we don't bring together, we tear apart. Love is not that. Love does not only seek its own way. Love is not easily angered. It does not keep record of wrongs. And Paul rounds out this list by saying, love does not delight in wrongdoing. Now, okay, how are we doing? So this is at a point in which I was thinking through this. I'm like, okay, I finally have one where I don't feel like such a terrible person, right? Until I stopped to think about, okay, Paul isn't all of a sudden thinking of a completely different list of things. You know, he's not suddenly thinking about wrongdoing as being, you know, murder or all the other stuff that we see in other places. He is thinking about what he has just mentioned, right? Love does not delight in wrongdoing. Now, this is like, you know, have you ever been on the road? You're driving down the road and you see signs that say traffic needs to merge because the lane is closed ahead, and you do what you're supposed to do and you get in the other lane, and then just people whoo, flying by you and they cut in everybody else in front. And you're like, oh, I just can't believe, you know, your time is so much more valuable than another's, right? Anybody ever thought that? You don't delight in what they're doing. If you are, stop it. Don't do that. Don't be that guy or girl. This isn't that. We would like to say that, yeah, I don't delight in wrongdoing, but the truth is, and I'm speaking personally here, the truth is, like, I do these things, right? I do these things. I act in these ways. And if I do these things and act in these ways, then it means at least some part of me enjoys doing that. Enjoys this kind of behavior. Paul says love doesn't enjoy doing it. It means it doesn't choose this. It actively works against these things to try to choose the way of love. And then he says it celebrates the truth. And again, this might be one of those like, I'm there, I celebrate the truth. And I don't know that this is necessarily like, I celebrate truth, but I celebrate when I am faced with my failure. When we are shown the truth of God's word, when we put the character of Christ alongside ours, we are going to be left wanting. and it's going to be painful. And apparently that is worth celebrating because it is an opportunity for growth. It is an opportunity to see where I lack, to know where I need to focus, to know what I need to work on, to know how I might need to be better. And while, yes, it can be painful, all growth is painful. And while left to my own devices, I might fail or will fail, the point is that I am not left to my own devices. I do have the example of Christ. I do have my brothers and sisters in Christ to keep me accountable and to help me walk the way of love. Paul ends his list with very singable words, right? He ends in a positive way. And I put on here the translation always rather than all things because I think it's a better understanding or idea of what Paul means. All things, if we really take literally all things, are we really supposed to believe everything? Are we supposed to believe all things? I think like every, you know, 2 + 2 is 955. You know, that would be believing all things. What he's getting at is that it's more like in all circumstances. Love is this way. Love are these things in every situation, always. That's what he means. And so he says love is always supportive. Or it might say love always bears up or bears with. It means that in our relationships with others, love is always other-focused. Love is always going to be a stable and supportive presence. Love is going to bear up under anything in order to make a relationship work. Love believes or it trusts always, right? Love always trusts that I'm in this relationship and it's going to be difficult and it could be hard, but I trust or I believe that God will do something with it. Love believes that it can be better. Love believes and trusts that God will work things out. And so love always hopes. It hopes for the best in the other person. Love tries and seeks to understand that what is it that has happened in this person's life that has led them to believe acting in this way or treating a person this way is okay? And boy, I hope they figure it out. I hope we can make a way forward here. And so love always perseveres. There will be setbacks and challenges, but love never gives up, and so love never fails. Love will always win. Paul concludes this passage with the endurance of love. He says, there's a lot that's going to pass away. Knowledge is going to pass away. We prophesy in part. We only know a little bit. But the only thing that truly lasts is love. Love is what remains. We sing the children's song, Love is Something If You Give It Away. Love is the only thing that lasts because it creates more and more and more of itself. And that's why Jesus says, I'm going to give you a new commandment. Not to love as the world loves. Not to love in the opposite of all of these ways, but to love as I do. And when you do, he goes on to say in John, the world will know. When you can love in this way, the world will know who you are and who I am. And so I want to close by going back through this. But this time, because we understand this isn't meant to be just sort of intellectual exercise about understanding what he's saying, but more to be transformational. And so I want you to think of someone in your life, someone you've interacted with over the last week or month or so. Someone in your life, a person in your life that maybe you don't get along with well. Maybe you're having a hard time with. Maybe you're struggling with. Maybe they rub you the wrong way or you're not getting along. Probably that's one of the easier things to come into your mind, right? But bring this person up into your mind. And I want you to be thinking about and asking yourself some questions as we look back through this. Who is the person that you have lost patience with recently? Who is someone that you have not been very kind to? Maybe there is a time in which you could not look past your own misfortune to enjoy their good fortune. Who have you spent more time talking about yourself than listening to? Who have you acted towards in ways that were arrogant and so created a situation in which they felt less human, less cared for? In what ways have you chosen or prioritized your own interests over the interest of another, and how has that affected your relationship? Who have you become angry with because they did not see things your way? And so who did you side to bear a grudge against because of that? As you think about these things, do you realize that you are in some ways choosing this sort of behavior? And can you pause and rejoice with an opportunity to make it right? And so what are ways that you can be supportive to this person? How might you trust that God will work it out? What are ways that you can hope for them to have a better life and a better relationship with you? And what will it take for you to persevere, to give love a chance, and to believe that love will not fail you in this relationship? My encouragement and challenge this morning is to allow this to go with you every day, to pray over this list, to not take it as a lump sum and just sort of toss it out the window as a generalization of what love is, but to actually let it work on your heart and transform the way you interact with others. That's the challenge. And so this morning, we want to offer you an opportunity for help. I mean, I need your help. If you see me acting in ways that violate any of these forms of love, I want you to just say, hey, how about do the way of love, my man? I don't know what you mean. This is tough. This is challenging to think through because it's like 16 ways that I fail every day in one way or another, right? But to be able to celebrate that, to celebrate that I know now the areas that I need to be better in, and to not set it aside and just feel guilty about it, because that's not the point. The point is not to feel guilty about the ways in which we fail, but to celebrate that we have the opportunity to walk in the way of love as Christ did. And that's a great thing. So if we can help you with that, we want to. But we also want to offer you the chance to join the way of love, right? We want to offer you a chance to step onto this path with us, to commit your life to Christ in baptism and receive the forgiveness of your sins, and join us in walking a way that is better, in a way that shows the world who we are and who we serve. If we can help you in any way this morning, we want to ask you to come while we stand and sing.